Case number 22-5263. Andrew F. Klein, individual in his official capacity as a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, et al., appellants, versus William J. Walker, in his official capacity as Sergeant at Arms of the U.S. House of Representatives, and Catherine Spindor, in her official capacity as Chief Administrative Officer of the U.S. House of Representatives. Mr. Cuccinelli for the appellant, Mr. Berry for the appellees.
Good morning, counsel. I think I still have 1 minute to say good morning. Mr. Cuccinelli, please proceed when you're ready.
Apologies to the clerk. If I could reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, I would appreciate it. I'm Ken Cuccinelli for the appellants in this matter. And that, as this court pointed out in Vanderjack in 1982, it's not the judiciary's role to tell Congress what rules they should adopt, but it is the judiciary's rule to tell Congress what they cannot adopt when those implementations are unconstitutional. The issue before this court is whether any constitutional protections may exist in the presence of the House's rulemaking power. The district court's dismissal of the case below effectively nullified the individual protections of the members under Article 1, Section 5, and under the 27th Amendment. And we respectfully suggest that this court should undertake 3 steps in overruling the district court below. First, with respect to subject matter jurisdiction, that it does exist, and I'll address that momentarily. That the speech or debate clause defense is inapplicable as a bar in this case, and to reach the merits of the case itself. A subject matter jurisdiction is interesting in the DC Circuit. It clearly exists in this case, but the nomenclature of this circuit has, with all due respect, been wrong for 50 years. This court's case law uses the word jurisdiction, but does speech or debate clause defense analysis, which is exactly what the district court did below. If the speech or debate clause were jurisdictional in the manner described frequently, at least in terms of the words used, the Supreme Court wouldn't have reached perhaps any of the speech or debate clause cases.
Mr. Cuccinelli, are you asking this panel to overturn the precedent of the circuit, which is something that we lack the authority to do?
No, I'm not, Your Honor. If you want to keep using the word jurisdiction, that's fine. Kilbourn uses the word defense. The Powell Court helpfully listed the 6 arguments that they were going to address. One was subject matter jurisdiction. Another was the speech or debate clause. I would just point out that the district court here did what often happens is they said they were dismissing the case for jurisdictional grounds, but in fact did an analysis that is a speech or debate clause defense analysis.
So it doesn't have to be subject matter jurisdiction, right? I think our cases have used the term jurisdiction. I don't recall one that actually said subject matter jurisdiction. So if it's jurisdiction, that just means it's a thing that we address at the threshold. And if it's not subject matter jurisdiction, then it could be the type of jurisdictional argument like sovereign immunity or something that can be waived by failure to assert it. But here it's been asserted.
And it has been asserted.
Yes. We have cases that speak of it in jurisdictional terms, more than one decision. And so then it's an issue that we address at the threshold, whether the speech or debate immunity applies.
And so let me address that. The error in analysis of the district court below was in this speech or debate clause analysis, treating the acts at issue as somehow as it couldn't be separated from the passage of H.R. 73. Instead of dealing with it as analyzing the implementation of H.R. 73, acknowledging that the passage of H.R. 73 is entirely protected under the speech or debate clause. But the context, which is the word used by the district court below, that it relied upon to convert what it called on page 8 of its own order, administrative functions, into legislative acts, as that phrase is used in speech or debate clause analysis, was the context of being the subject of a House rule, the product of a House rule, the majoritarian power of the House to write its own rule.
Mr. Cuccinelli, you don't question that enacting a rule of proceeding is not within the jurisdiction of the House.
Correct. I do not.
And you are not alleging that this particular rule establishing security procedures is itself unconstitutional.
On its face, no. In implementation, it is.
But not on its face.
Correct. Yes. So HR 73 says nothing about magnetometers. It just refers to security.
But you don't think the use of magnetometers would be unconstitutional?
Well, it impeded members from voting, including Representative Clyde, one of the plaintiffs here. We cited others who couldn't vote because of how this rule was implemented on their most fundamental responsibility. And the fines were assessed for literally just walking onto the floor, which under no circumstance could reasonably be called disorderly behavior. And the problem that the House hasn't addressed is the elimination of the individual members' protections that are explicit in the Constitution. The disorderly behavior restriction is a restraint on the power of the House's ability to punish members and therefore to pass rules, not to pass the rules, but the nature of the rules has to respect that to punish a member requires disorderly behavior.
And you think that's a standard that is susceptible to judicial determination?
Well, if it isn't susceptible to judicial determination, then it is left to the House to determine for itself. And that is a classic wolf guarding the sheep. That's the House just saying, trust us. And the court clearly reaches many speech or debate clause cases. And we believe that they should overrule the court below, reach this one, and address the merits, that the actions to implement H.R. 73 were not legislative acts.
So sometimes implementation acts can be legislative acts.
Yes.
Obviously, sometimes they can be. And so the question is, where does this one fall? And the Supreme Court's language in Gravel says, in deciding whether something counts as a legislative act, even though it's not core speech or debate, that it must be an integral part of the deliberative and communicative processes by which members participate in House proceedings. And so that you're not taking issue with the proposition that determining the conditions under which somebody goes on the House floor and who goes on the House floor is an integral part of the communicative processes, deliberative processes by which members participate in House proceedings. Your argument is that even if that's true, imposition of a fine and exaction of the fine is not. Is that my understanding your argument conceptually correctly?
Very close.
Okay.
So I would say that a security rule that in any way impedes the access of the members to the floor does trigger a constitutional problem. I mean, they're missing votes.
You may have an argument on the merits about whether it triggers a constitutional problem. I guess what I'm trying to understand is it within the fold of speech or debate clause immunity?
Okay.
And so, on that, I didn't understand you to take issue with the proposition that having a rule about who can come on the floor and what conditions they come on the floor to engage in the deliberative and communicative processes by which members participate in House proceedings, because that's what happens on the floor. I didn't understand you to say that that filter was itself something that's outside of speech or debate immunity.
Correct.
So no, what you're focused on
is the overstate. Yes.
And what you're focused on is, even if that's within speech or debate immunity, the exaction of the fine as the consequence of violating the thing that we just said is within speech or debate immunity, that's outside of speech or debate. That's the way you're conceiving.
So on the former, what we call the doorkeeping role, is not a legislative act. So we would not concede that that is an intimate part of the legislative process. That doesn't suggest there can't be some security mechanism for accessing the floor, as does exist. However, that is not a legislative function done by members as members, to use some of the other court phrasing. And the payroll function is actually got a finding from the Third Circuit, a holding that it is not a legislative function.
Why didn't you challenge that then?
Well, we did.
I thought what you were challenging is the fine. And the
extraction of the fine,
right,
as well, yes, under the 27th Amendment. I'm just not leaving aside the disorderly behavior protection for the members, and as if walking onto the floor is somehow disorderly or embarrassing to the House. If the House gets to define disorderly via passing a rule, then we've written the disorderly behavior protection out of the Constitution, out of Article 1, Section 5. Both have to be able to exist together, and that does, Your Honor, require a judicial description of what are those boundaries. It's describing those boundaries is the province of the court. And because these are not legislative acts of themselves, the doorkeeping function and the payroll function, this case should not have been dismissed, and it should have reached the merits. And by the way, I would note that addressing whether these acts are legislative is not a merits question. That is only, the merits question is only accessed by determining that they are not.
Right, deciding whether the legislative acts goes to speech or debate immunity,
yes,
not to the ultimate merits of your claim. But so you don't think that determining the conditions under which members access the floor for purposes of engaging in the, I think you'd at least agree that what members do on the floor is an integral part of the deliberative and communicative processes by which members participate in House proceedings.
Yes, I can't think of examples when I would not agree with that.
Right, right. And so then determining the conditions under which members come onto the floor to do that, you don't think is an integral part of the deliberative and communicative processes by which members participate in House proceedings.
So this starts to get awfully close to the court's allowance for the House to make rules. It has no say in that, but to only step in when those rules in implementation somehow violate other constitutional rights, the language of Ballin and Vanderjack. And that's the situation here. The way this was implemented was impeding votes of members. It actively blocked people, including one of my three clients, from a vote, their most fundamental undertaking. And the sergeant at arms, the doorkeeper, applied the fine. The chief administrative officer collected the fine, but it was the sergeant at arms, the doorkeeper, who decided that the rule was broken, and the implication being, assuming there is a protection against being fined for disorderly behavior, that the member had committed disorderly behavior.
And so we have a case, Consumers Union, for example, which has to do with whether a press entity can get in the gallery of the House,
yes,
chamber. And we held that the enforcement of that rule, which prohibited the press entity from getting into the gallery, was within speech or debate immunity. So that case couldn't go forward. Yeah. And this case is about whether a member can get to the floor. If there's speech or debate immunity for whether a press entity can get to the gallery of the floor, how is there not speech or debate immunity for whether a member can get to the floor?
So judging by your question, Your Honor, I would flip it around that there is much more opportunity to control the access of non-members than of members, which is what was done in Consumers Union. And I would point out the members themselves personally made those decisions for the first 100 years of the House about which press got to access the floor. So when you think of what are things that members do as members, the Consumers Union case spells out the history that members did this. They clearly thought that press access to their proceedings was an intimate part of the legislative process, presumably because of the communication back and forth to constituents, but they were non-members. And when they were on the floor, they were lobbying members while legislation was under consideration. And so they were removed from the floor up to the gallery. And at a certain point, the Congress delegated the decision, because there are only so many seats, of deciding who may access that gallery to essentially a commission of non-members, but did maintain voting control over those decisions in a way that was not maintained with H.R. 73. So you have non-members who were literally lobbying on the floor in the midst of legislative consideration, who were removed from the floor. And speech or debate clause protection was provided because The context, which is what I feel like there's fourth judge here, Judge Ginsburg and Walker, analyzing Consumers Union, talked about this context and the atmosphere of legislation on the floor. But that atmosphere was with respect to non-members who were lobbying members on the floor.
But with non-members and members, I guess it seems to me, if we're talking not about the merits, but about speech or debate immunity, the fact that this case involves members seems like it more squarely implicates speech or debate immunity than less squarely implicates it, because it actually has to do with members on the floor as opposed to non-members in the gallery.
So the reason it is less applicable, one, is because I don't think anybody would dispute that House members have the right to access the floor that press members don't. This is the place where their job happens, mm-hmm. where the legislating happens. So in that sense, that's one removal of Consumers Union. Another is there are no member rights that press members have that my clients do. And that is not to be punished for behavior that isn't disorderly. Even if they have to comply with certain requirements, there's no allegation that any other rule or any other requirements weren't in compliance by any of the members. And then they also, when the fines are removed from their pay, that varied their pay downward, it lowered their pay, contrary to the 27th Amendment. That's not a legislative act, the payroll function, as the Third Circuit held.
And are you indicating that we should analyze that separately, essentially the administration of the rule versus the enforcement of the rule?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I heard you wrong. The implementation of the two parts are the passage of the rule, which the House clearly has the power to pass rules, and this court and the Supreme Court have always made clear, we're not going to invade the province of the House's rulemaking power. However, when rules that in implementation either violate other individual or constitutional rights or are illegal in some way, that portion of this chain of causation may be reviewed by the courts and has been repeatedly by this court and by the Supreme Court. That's what I meant, Your Honor.
Mr. Cuccinelli, though, if any time a member raises one of these arguments and then we decide that there's not speech or debate immunity, how would that not impact the independence of Congress as a separate branch?
So if I could bring three pieces together in answering that. One, I'd compare to the McCarthy case 2 years ago, where the act, again, skipping the voting to implement how they vote, but the implementation was about voting. I mean, it was about as intimate an element of the legislative process as you can get. Then you have the Ballin case that was about quorum, determining quorum and voting. So, those kinds of implementations of these truly legislative elements, I don't think the court could ever get into. However, where there are specific other protections, like the disorderly behavior protection, like the protection of unvaried salary, that if the court doesn't...
argument is that if there is like an invasion of the members' constitutional rights, and so the way that members vote, or, some of those questions, those could easily be recharacterized as invading the members' constitutional powers.
Well, and in the early 80s, the distribution...
And then those would be reviewable also by this court, which would be, in tension with this court's even very recent precedents.
I fully recognize the tension between the two branches, and which is also first and most respected by the courts, without exception, hands-off approach to the House passing rules and not sitting in judgment of any of them ever. But again, how some of them do get enforced is another matter. And this speech or debate clause is intended to maintain the independence you referenced, and perhaps more critically, to not have legislators bothered and taken from their legislative function by being dragged into court. And that's not who's here. That is not who we sued. did not sue the speaker. We did not sue the members. We sued those who were implementing in a way that violated constitutional rights, House Rule 73. So we're respecting that difference. And it isn't that the court never has a role to play. We believe the court does have a role to play here, and that we're asking for a respectful resolution. By respectful, I mean respectful of the differences between the two branches, but also not allowing the writing out of individual protections, a la Ballin, from the Constitution that the members have a right to expect.
Sure, my colleagues don't have additional questions for you at this time. We'll hear from the Council of the House. Mr. Berry.
May it please the court. House Resolution 73 was controversial. Every member of the current House leadership voted against it, believing it to be misguided. And the security screening requirements contained in the resolution were not reimposed at the beginning of this Congress. But this case is not about the wisdom of House Resolution 73. Rather, it is primarily about whether appellant's suit is barred by the speech or debate clause, and then, if their suit is not precluded, whether the fines for violating the resolution run afoul of the 27th Amendment or the Constitution's discipline clause. And if I may turn to some of the points that my friend made, I think that the attempt to divorce the enforcement and administration of the resolution with the implementation or adoption of the resolution just is not consistent with precedent. As the Chief Judge pointed out in McCarthy in discussing the Consumers Union case, this court specifically said that the speech or debate clause applied to the administration and enforcement of rules governing seating in press galleries, not just the promulgation of. And so too should be the case here, particularly in an instance where you're dealing with the regulation of member conduct and the members actually on the floor, not just in the gallery, which I think, as the Chief Judge indicated, is even more core to the legislative process. The second thing I would note is that—
But I think there's an argument that it's, even if that's true, even if members on the floor are more core than non-members in the gallery, their argument is that voting is more core than withdrawal of salary.
So what's
your response to that? Because I think you're right that per McCarthy and per other decisions, Consumers Union itself and Gravel seems to presuppose that implementation definitely can be a legislative act. But the question becomes, is the implementation at issue a legislative
act? And I think it is, Your Honor, because it's part of a scheme that regulates the very atmosphere in which lawmaking deliberation occurs. I also think it's a legislative act because it's part of a congressional discipline proceeding. In Rangel, this court said that a congressional discipline proceeding is a legislative matter that the Constitution places within the jurisdiction of the House. And what this court said in Rangel was the censure that was the end product, the execution of the disciplinary proceeding was not judicially reviewable. It was protected by the speech or debate clause. In this instance, it was not a censure that was the result of the disciplinary proceeding. It was a fine, but I don't see why the principle of the legislative act being an execution of a disciplinary proceeding would be the same.
The censure was promulgated by members?
It was, but there was the clerk had a role in actually implementing the censure and placing it, I believe, in the congressional practice. I think that what we're talking about here is not only a disciplinary proceeding, but a regulation of the very atmosphere in which lawmaking deliberations occur. And my friend has mentioned Ballin a number of times in the oral argument in the brief, but I think the key thing is that Ballin is not a speech or debate clause case. There was no congressional party that was a party to that case. And the speech or debate clause issue was never raised. So Ballin cannot speak to the issue of whether certain things are legislative acts and whether you look to the speech or debate clause first and decide that immunity question before you turn to the merits of whatever claim there is that the House rule is in violation of the Constitution. And I think with respect to the issue here, once you say that it's a legislative act, for instance, it does not matter whether we're talking about members or non-members. My learned friend says that while non-members are not being bothered, they're not being hauled into court. Members are not being bothered, not being hauled into court, and thus the purpose of the clause is satisfied if you're only suing non-members. But that is not consistent with this court's precedent. It's not consistent with what this court said in McCarthy. It's not consistent with Gravel, because part of the purpose is that the legislative branch as a whole, the legislature, should not be dragged into court and forced to deal with what can be a hostile judiciary. It's a separation of powers issue. And so the fact you're talking about officers of the House who are appointed by the Speaker versus members of the House, the distinction there is not relevant for purposes of the speech or debate clause in terms of what the underlying function of
so
the
you're is. Oh, go ahead.
Mr. Ware, I was going to ask you, is there any circumstance in which, you know, the House enacts a rule of proceeding and implements it that a challenge to the rule or its implementation could be cognizable by this court? Are all rules of proceeding and all implementation of such rules beyond judicial cognizance?
Well, number one, I certainly don't think to win this case, the answer to that question has to be yes. And I'm not going to assert, given the scope of House rules, that there can never be a House rule, the implementation of which would not be covered by the speech or debate clause. I would concede the possibility there could be House rules that regulate things that are not do not fall within what we would consider legislative acts. But I think, again, here we have very specific case law on point in terms of the press gallery case precedent about regulating the very atmosphere in which the deliberations of the Congress apply, the Rangel precedent in terms of congressional discipline being a matter that's within the jurisdiction of the legislature, the execution of that discipline not being covered. So the fact that there may be cases where you could challenge House rules and the speech or debate clause would not apply, I don't think means that in this.
Well, I take it under your argument, the House rules, I don't know how broad the House rules power ranges, but under the Supreme Court's precedents that we've adopted, on the letter of our decisions, in order to fit within speech debate immunity, the matter at issue, meaning what's covered by the House rule, has to be an integral part of the deliberative and communicative process by which members participate in House proceedings.
Yes, and I think that there very well could be House rules that do not meet that test. For instance, if there's a House rule saying that there are going to be tacos served in the House cafeteria every Tuesday, I do not believe that we would claim that that's the execution of that would be protected by speech or debate clause.
Not even by someone who really wanted their tacos?
Excuse me?
Not even by a member who really wanted their tacos?
I mean, if they wanted a taco on Wednesday, you know. But in more serious notes, something regulating that, for instance.
Well, we have a case, for example, with the
house restaurant.
Food service worker. And it's mm-hmm.
I'm not claiming that so there are no house. Yeah. There could be house rules, and there probably are house rules, to which the legislative act test is not met. What I'm saying is in this case, I very much believe and precedent indicates that the legislative act test is met.
This case doesn't indicate any boundary issue, is what you're suggesting.
Oh, no, I think it is. Again, we're talking about magnetometers that were placed directly outside the House chamber after January 6th. And I think that it regulates the very atmosphere in which the lawmaking delivers.
So that might, but I think there was some resistance to that too. But even if that does, the question is, does the consequence of not going through the magnetometer, i.e. the imposition of the fine and the exaction of the fine from the salary, is that integrally related to, is it an integral part of the communicative process by which members participate in House proceedings?
And I would say, Your Honor, pursuant to this court's precedent, the answer is yes, because the administration and enforcement of the press gallery access rules was deemed to be a legislative act protected by speech and debate clause immunity, and the execution of congressional discipline, whether it be by censure or a fine, is considered to be a matter that is within the jurisdiction of the House and was protected by speech or debate clause.
I mean, in Consumers Union, there wasn't the imposition of a fine. It was just that the entity that wanted to get in wasn't allowed to get in. And so so from your view, if the consequence of trying to get in when you don't have the pass to get in is that you're subject to a fine, and then that entity tried to challenge the imposition of the fine, you'd still say that's a legislative act.
I would say that.
And that's
absolutely. And if I know my time's running out, if I could briefly turn to the merits of the two claims here at issue. With respect to this,
just make sure there's not additional questions on future debate immunity, because that was what the district court decision rested on.
But just whether or not we need to bifurcate the screening versus the fine.
Right. Again, I think that the district court was correct that you're talking about a scheme regulating the behavior on the House chamber, and that the enforcement aspect of it is an integral part of the scheme. So I think the district court was right on that, and it's supported by the fact that in Consumers Union, this court did not distinguish between the promulgation of the rule, the administration of the rule, and the enforcement of the rule. They saw it also as a scheme, and the fact that this is a disciplinary proceeding, and the Rangel court decision teaches that the enforcement of the discipline, the implementation of the discipline, is protected by the speech or debate clause. And I don't think the fact this is a fine versus a censure matters in terms of the protection that's given to the congressional discipline proceeding.
One follow-up question on that, and then we'll just give you a brief minute to talk about the merits, but Powell versus McCormick.
Mm-hmm.
So that involved two measures that were implementation measures. One was withholding of the salary, and the other was the doorkeeper kept going into the chamber. And those, the Supreme Court said there was no speech or debate immunity. And so your distinction of that is?
Well, I would have three answers, Your Honor. The first is it's a technical matter. It was the back pay issue that was not moved by the time that reached the court. But secondly, as Your Honor said in the McCarthy case, the best way to interpret Powell is that these were not legislative acts. I think the most logical way of looking at it is that the wholesale exclusion of a member from the body, meaning that they don't get paid, they're not considered to be a member. And one of the things is you don't get to go on the floor. The wholesale exclusion is not a legislative act. That's very different than a rule of general applicability, which regulates members' conduct and says that it doesn't stop you from getting on the floor, but if you go on the floor without going through security screening, you're going to get fined. I also think that there's certainly tension between the reasoning in Powell between members versus non-members and what came later in terms of Gravel and what's come later in terms of this court's precedent, such as of McCarthy. And then just very briefly on disorderly behavior, I think that the dictionary definitions, whether it be at the time or now, give a definition of disorderly behavior as being contrary to the rules, contrary to law. And I think that the precedents indicate this, that the Congress has very broad discretion to define disorderly behavior. And if there's a rule that says you have to go get a security screening before going on the House floor, you don't go through the magnetometer, I think it is reasonable to say that that is not consistent with ordered behavior. If I show up to the airport and say I'm not going to go through the magnetometer at the checkpoint, I'm just going to walk around it, I don't think many people would say that that's ordered behavior. I think a reasonable person would say that's disorderly behavior. Second, with respect to the 27th Amendment issue, as I understand their brief, they're not challenging the imposition of the fine. They're saying the method of collection is unconstitutional. But we strongly believe that's not the case. They're given 90 days to pay the fine. If not, then it gets deducted from one's paycheck. There are many reasons why deductions are made from one's salary for the compensation for services. For instance, if you don't pay your child support, you can have your wages garnished, deducted from your salary. People don't say that if your wages are garnished for not paying child support, your salary, your compensation for services has been reduced. Your salary is the same, but some of it is just diverted for another purpose. Here, the salary, the compensation has not been changed, but some of it has been diverted for another purpose, which is paying the debt that they owe to the House because they haven't paid their fine. And there's a specific statute on the books that allows the House to collect debts through deductions from the paycheck. So, Your Honor, I think even if you get to the merits, the district court could still be affirmed. But I think pursuant to this court's decisions in Consumers Union, McCarthy, and Rangel, it is clear that these are legislative acts and that speech or debate clause immunity applies.
And just quickly, how long have fines been being deducted from salaries?
So the fines ended at the end of the last Congress. So the way they did it is they divided it up so that when the fines were imposed, a certain amount was taken out of paycheck so that the fine would be satisfied by the end. That's what happened with respect to then Congressman Gohmert. Mm-hmm. Now, the other two appellants basically had almost their entire paycheck was being withheld for tax purposes. So all that could be done was that it could be deducted about a dollar a pay period. So for Mr. Clyde, Mr. Smucker, they had to pay, I think, roughly about $18 in fines. That's all that the House was able to take. But they're not having deductions anymore because the ability to collect the fine ended at the end of the last Congress.
And is that something the House has been doing over time, fines being deducted from salaries?
So that has been the statute allowing deductions for debt has been on the books for many, many years. And that is a way that has been that this has been implemented. But it's also the case that the fines, the collection of the fines ends at the end of the Congress when the fine was imposed, because the House, unlike the Senate, is not a continuing body. The House Congress ends at the end of each Congress and completely reconstitutes itself at the beginning of the current Congress, as was rather dramatically portrayed at the beginning of this.
Mr. Berry, you said it was a statute that allows for the garnishment of fines, or is it?
There's a statute that allows for the deduction of debts owed to the House.
But it's a statute, not
yes,
a rule.
And we did cite it in our brief.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Guccinelli, we'll give you the 2 minutes for rebuttal you asked for.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I would start with the lack of general applicability of these fines. Even the child support example in Hatter is analogous with the judiciary 20 years ago. But these are fines directed to specific members taken specifically from their pay. And when you read H.R. 73, it was written to take it from the pay. Mr. Berry correctly described the financial results for my three clients, and it perfectly exemplifies one of the concerns of the founders in putting the 27th Amendment in and it having been passed. And that is that they're not, that pay not be able, money not be able to be used to put pressure on members that would make a difference between poor men and rich men then, now women as well, being representatives in Congress. And here we have a real live example of it. I would also point out that in Powell, the exclusion of a member by the doorkeeper and the payroll deduction are about as close on point to the factual acts at issue here as you could find. Now, the court didn't go out of its way to make holdings specific to them, but implicitly the Supreme Court in Powell found both the doorkeeper function and the payroll function to be legislative acts. Otherwise, they could not have then reached the end of the case that they did. And recently, we provided the court the Third Circuit case where it was an actual holding of the Third Circuit under speech or debate clause analysis, finding the payroll function in a Pennsylvania legislative subpoena case to be a legislative act. So that's the only holding that we're aware of, which is why we provided to the court. And thus the lower court should be overruled on that basis. And just with respect to Rangel, I would note that the House went through its ordinary discipline process. The whole House voted on the censure that was determined by the House to be disorderly behavior. That doesn't mean it automatically is under the Constitution, but that wasn't a basis on which it was challenged. And what was done there was a legislative act, the reading of a censure. There was no fine. Here, the power was delegated to the sergeant at arms in the doorkeeper function to essentially write a ticket. And he wrote a ticket to my three clients, one of them twice. And so they owe fines. There is not a vote of the House as there was in Rangel. The ethics committee that was sort of the appellate body was divided evenly on a partisan basis, 5-5. And so the majoritarian abuse that is the beginning of this case can't be addressed in an equally divided committee. And it was probably designed that way, but that's not for us to question here. It is for us to recognize that the process there was not an ordinary legislative process that relied on a majority vote to determine what had happened in each of these instances. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. We'll take this case under submission.